Chapter 58. Informed of up-to-the-minute events from California by Admiral Sandecker and Agents Gaskell and Ragsdale in El Paso, the Secretary of State decided to sidestep diplomatic protocol and personally call the President of Mexico. He briefed him on the far-reaching theft and smuggling conspiracy engineered by the Zolars. "An incredible story," said Mexico's president. "But true," the Secretary of State assured him. "I can only regret the incident occurred, and I promise my government's full cooperation with the investigation. If you will forgive me, Mr. President, I do have a wish list of requests. Let's hear them." Within 2 hours, the border between Mexico and California was reopened. The government officials, who were suckered by the Zolars into jeopardizing their positions by false promises of incredible riches, were rounded up. Fernando Matos and Police Comandante Rafael Cortina were among the first to be arrested by Mexican justice investigators. At the same time, vessels of the Mexican Navy attached to the Sea of Cortez were alerted and ordered to sea. Lieutenant Carlos Hidalgo peered up at a squawking gull before turning his attention back to the straight line of the sea across the horizon. "Are we searching for anything special or just searching?" he casually asked his ship's captain. "Looking for bodies," Commander Miguel Maderas replied. He lowered his binoculars, revealing a round, friendly face under long, thick black hair. His teeth were large and very white, and almost always set in a Burt Lancaster smile. He was short and heavy and solid as a rock. Hidalgo was a sharp contrast to Maderas. Tall and lean with a narrow face, he looked like a well-tanned cadaver. "Victims of a boating accident?" "No, divers who drowned in an underground river." Hidalgo's eyes narrowed skeptically. "Not another gringo folktale about fishermen and divers being swept under the desert and disgorged into the Gulf." "Who is to say?" Maderas replied with a shrug. "All I know is that orders from our fleet headquarters in Ensenada directed our ship and crew to patrol the waters on the northern end of the Gulf between San Felipe and Puerto Penasco for any sign of bodies. A large area for only one ship to cover. We'll be joined by two Class P patrol boats out of Santa Rosalia, and all fishing boats in the area have been alerted to report any sighting of human remains." "If the sharks get them," Hidalgo muttered pessimistically, "there won't be anything left to find." Maderas leaned back against the railing of the bridge wing, lit a cigarette, and gazed toward the stern of his patrol vessel. It had been modified from a 67-meter, 220-foot, U.S. Navy minesweeper, and had no official name other than the big G-21 painted on the bow. But the crew unaffectionately called her El Porqueria, piece of trash, because she once broke down at sea and was towed to port by a fishing boat, a humiliation the crew never forgave her for. But she was a sturdy ship, quick to answer the helm, and stable in heavy seas. The crews of more than one fishing boat and private yacht owed their lives to Maderas and El Porqueria. As executive officer of the ship, Hidalgo had the duty of plotting a search grid. When he was finished poring over a large nautical chart of the northern Gulf, he gave the coordinates to the helmsman. Then the dreary part of the voyage began, plowing down one lane and then reversing course as if mowing a lawn. The first line was run at 8 o'clock in the morning. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, a lookout on the bow yelled out, "Object in the water!" "Where away?" shouted Hidalgo. 150 meters off the port bow." Maderas lifted his binoculars and peered over the blue-green water. He easily spotted a body floating face down as it rose on the crest of a wave. "I have it." He stepped to the wheelhouse door and nodded at the helmsman. "Bring us alongside and have a crew stand by to retrieve. Then he turned to Hidalgo. Stop engines when we close to 50 meters. The foaming bow wave faded to a gentle ripple. The heavy throb of the twin diesels died to a muted rumble as the patrol vessel slipped alongside the body, rolling in the waves. From his view on the bridge wing, Medeiros could see the bloated and distorted features had been battered to pulp. Small wonder the sharks didn't find it appetizing, he thought. He stared at Hidalgo and smiled. We didn't need a week after all. We got lucky, Hidalgo mumbled. With no hint of reverence for the dead, two crewmen jabbed a boat hook into the floating corpse and pulled it toward a stretcher, constructed from wire mesh, that was lowered into the water. The body was guided into the stretcher and raised onto the deck. The ghastly, mangled flesh barely resembled what had once been a human being. Medeiros could hear more than one of his crew retching into the sea before the corpse was zipped into a body bag. Well, at least whoever he was did us a favor, said Hidalgo. Medeiros looked at him. Oh, and what was that? Hidalgo grinned unfeelingly. He wasn't in the water long enough to smell. 3 hours later, the patrol vessel entered the breakwater of San Felipe and tied up alongside the Alhambra. As Pitt had suspected, after reaching shore in the life raft, Gordo Padilla and his crew had gone home to their wives and girlfriends and celebrated their narrow escape by taking a 3-day siesta. Then, under the watchful eye of Cortina's police, Padilla rounded everyone up and hitched a ride on a fishing boat back to the ferry. Once on board, they raised steam in the engines and pumped out the water taken on when Amaru opened the seacocks. When her keel was unlocked by the silt and her engines were fired to life, Padilla and his crew sailed the Alhambra back to San Felipe and tied her to the dock. To Medeiros and Hidalgo, looking down from their bridge, the forward car deck of the ferry looked like the accident ward of a hospital. Lauren Smith was comfortably dressed in shorts and halter top, and exhibited her bruises and a liberal assortment of small bandages over her bare shoulders, midriff, and legs. Jordino sat in a wheelchair with both legs propped ahead of him in plaster casts. Missing was Rudy Gunn, who was in stable condition in the El Centro Regional Medical Center just north of Calexico. After having survived a badly bruised stomach, 6 broken fingers, and a hairline fracture of the skull. Admiral Sandecker and Peter Duncan, the hydrologist, also stood on the deck of the ferryboat, along with Shannon Kelsey, Miles Rogers, and a contingent of local police and the Baja California Norte State Coroner. Their faces were grim as the crew of the Navy patrol ship lowered the stretcher containing the body onto the Alhambra's deck. Before the coroner and his assistant could lift the body bag onto a gurney, Jordino pushed his wheelchair up to the stretcher. "I would like to see the body," he said grimly. "He is not a pretty sight, senor," Hidalgo warned him from the deck of his ship. The coroner hesitated, not sure if under the law he could permit foreigners to view a dead body. Jordino stared coldly at the coroner. "Do you want an identification or not?" The coroner, a little man with bleary eyes and a great bush of gray hair, barely knew enough English to understand Jordino, but he nodded silently to his assistant who pulled down the zipper. Lauren paled and turned away. But Sandecker moved close beside Jordino. "Is it?" Jordino shook his head. "No, it's not dirt. It's that psycho creep Tupac Amaru. Good Lord, he looks as if he was churned through an empty cement mixer." "Almost as bad," said Duncan, shuddering at the ghastly sight. "The rapids must have beat him against every rock between here and Cerro El Caparote." "Couldn't happen to a nicer guy," Jordino muttered acidly. "Somewhere between the treasure cavern and the gulf," said Duncan, "the river must erupt into a rampage." "No sign of another body?" Sandecker asked Hidalgo. "Nothing, senor. This is the only one we found, but we have orders to continue the search for the second man. Sandecker turned away from Amaru. If Dirk hasn't been cast out into the gulf by now, he must still be underground. Maybe he was washed up on a beach or a sandbank, offered Shannon hopefully. He might still be alive. Can't you launch an expedition down the subterranean river to find him? Rogers asked the Admiral. Sandecker shook his head slowly. I won't send a team of men to certain death. The Admiral is right, said Giordino. There could be a dozen cascades like the one Pitt and I went over. Even with a hovercraft like the Wallowing Windbag, it's extremely doubtful anyone can gain safe passage through 100 kilometers of water peppered with rapids and rocks. If that isn't enough, added Duncan, there's the submerged caverns to get through before surfacing in the gulf. Without an ample air supply, drowning would be inescapable. How far do you think he might drift? Sandecker asked him. From the treasure chamber? Yes. Duncan thought a moment. Pitt might have a chance if he managed to reach a dry shore within 500 meters. We could tie a man on a guideline and safely send him downstream that far, and then pull them back against the current. And if no sign of Pitt is found before the guideline runs out? Asked Giordino. Duncan shrugged solemnly. Then, if his body doesn't surface in the gulf, we'll never find him. Is there any hope for Dirk? Lauren pleaded. Any hope at all? Duncan looked from Giordino to Sandecker before answering. All eyes reflected abject hopelessness, and their faces were etched with despair. He turned back to Lauren and said gently, I can't lie to you, Miss Smith. The words appeared to cause him great discomfort. Dirk's chances are as good as any badly injured man's of reaching Lake Mead outside of Las Vegas, after being cast adrift in the Colorado River at the entrance to the Grand Canyon. Words came like a physical blow to Lauren. She began to sway on her feet. Giordino reached out and grabbed her arm. It seemed that her heart stopped, and she whispered, To me, Dirk Pitt will never die. The fish are a little shy today, said Joe Hagen to his wife, Claire. She was lying on her belly on the roof of the boat's main cabin, barely wearing a purple bikini with the halter untied, reading a magazine. She pushed her sunglasses on top of her head and laughed. You couldn't catch a fish if it jumped up and landed in the boat, he laughed. Just wait and see. The only fish you'll find this far north in the Gulf is shrimp. She nagged. The Hagens were in their early 60s and in reasonably good shape. As with most women her age, Claire's bottom had spread and her waist carried a little flab, but her face was fairly free of wrinkles and her breasts were still large and firm. Joe was a big man who fought a losing battle with a paunch that had grown into a well-rounded stomach. Together they ran a family auto dealership in Anaheim, specializing in clean, low-mileage used cars. After Joe bought a 15-meter, 50-foot ocean-going catch and named it the first attempt out of Newport Beach, California, they began leaving the management of their business to their two sons. They liked to sail down the coast and around Cabo San Lucas into the Sea of Cortez, spending the fall months cruising back and forth between picturesque ports nestled on the shores. This was the first time they had sailed this far north. As he lazily trolled for whatever fish took a fancy to his bait, Joe kept half an eye on the fathometer as he idled along on the engine with the sails furled. The tides at this end of the gulf could vary as much as 7 meters, 23 feet, and he didn't want to run on an uncharted sandbar. He relaxed as the stylus showed a depression under the keel to be over 50 meters, 164 feet deep. A puzzling feature, he thought. The seafloor on the north end of the gulf was uniformly shallow, seldom going below 10 meters at high tide. The bottom was usually a mixture of silt and sand. The fathometer read the underwater depression as uneven hard rock. Aha, they laughed at all the great geniuses, said Joe, as he felt a tug on his trolling line. He reeled it in and discovered a California corbina about the length of his arm on the hook. Claire shaded her eyes with one hand. He's too pretty to keep. Throw the poor thing back. That's odd. What's odd? All the other corbinas I've ever caught had dark spots on a white body. This sucker is colored like a fluorescent canary. She adjusted her halter and came astern to have a closer look at his catch. Now this is really weird, said Joe, holding up one hand and displaying palm and fingers that were stained a bright yellow. If I weren't a sane man, I'd say somebody dyed this fish. He sparkles under the sun as if his scales were spangles, said Claire. Joe peered over the side of the boat. The water in this one particular area looks like it was squeezed out of a lemon. Could be a good fishing hole. You may be right, old girl. Joe moved past her to the bow and threw out the anchor. This looks as good a place as any to spend the afternoon angling for a big one.